We acknowledge the people of Ngāi-Tahu Iwi, of Te Wai Pōnamu, Aotearoa, who welcomed Alone Australia onto their land. And we acknowledge the Cammeraygal people as the traditional owners of the land we're recording on. We pay deepest respect to First Nations elders, past and present, and all First Nations people. Welcome to Alone Australia, the podcast. I'm Gina Chick.
And I'm Darren Mara. Each week, Gina and I, we're watching the show with you and we're breaking down everything that happens.
So, episode 8, we're well and truly at the pointy end. Let's talk it over before we chat with Rick.
And we're also getting a visit from ARIA award-winning Australian singer-songwriter Josh Pike, who is an Alone mega fan. We started this episode with a huge storm.
A stonker.
A stonking storm bearing down heavily on all of our participants. And we got a really good look at their shelters and how some of their shelters were going to be holding up. What did you think about some of the best shelters we've seen so far in this episode and some of the worst that look like they may give participants some issues?
It's a really good question. In survival, as I keep saying in the lineage that I'm a part of, the number one priority is shelter because we die fastest from hypothermia. And our shelter starts with our clothes, and it's also our physical shelter, and fire can be a part of that. And what we want with a shelter is we want to be able to preserve heat, because every calorie that we burn is a calorie that we then have to go out and replace. And we're seeing this now that we're, you know, over the 30-day mark, where people are they're lost quite a lot, if not most, of their body fat, might be finding it hard to get fuel in the way of food. And so now preserving their heat is vital. You can get away with a kind of crappy shelter until the weather comes in. And this is what we're seeing here. Now that this storm is here, it's showing the cracks in shelters. So the one that really stood out for me was Rick's, because
he's so exposed.
There's no heat preservation in that shelter. There's like the walls are open, the air comes through, and he doesn't even have protection from the rain. So he's getting his sleeping bag splashed, which means that his down sleeping bag is now essentially useless because you can't get down wet. It clumps together and then it doesn't maintain heat.
So we saw him trying to dry it over the fire. So that the chances of that actually working and him drying it successfully, that's like near impossible.
Well, you can dry it, but if you don't get the declumping happening, and maybe he'd sort of spent the time to declump, we don't know. We can ask him because he's going to be coming in. So seeing his shelter, I just was like, oh my goodness, I'm really curious to talk to him about his shelter choices. And considering he hasn't eaten for like a month, to not have a warm shelter and to be getting bone cold is a real problem. Then on the other hand, we see Tamika, who's got her wizard house and the stove that she's got in there, the rock fireplace. That would be generating so much heat, and we see her toasty and warm in there. So her shelter's great. We also saw that Susan, who moved her shelter, which was a big call and a massive calorie burn, her shelter held up and her new site actually stood her in good stead. So her shelter's doing pretty well. Andrea's shelter looks really good. It looks really sturdy. And Christoph's shelter looks amazing. But the thing I love about Christoph is that he is insulating his roof. I've been shouting at the TV like an armchair
aloner. So talk us through what he's doing there, where he's putting the tree branches across the top and he's getting sort of stuff just from the ground and stuffing it in there. What's the idea there?
What we're looking at is we want to create air spaces. And if you've just got a tarp, the heat is just going to go straight through that thing. So all of their roofs, their heat is rising and just going straight out the tarp. Christoph's the only one that's properly insulating his roof, and he's doing it with debris. Now, debris is the leaf litter that's on the forest floor. If you pile that up, it creates insulation in air spaces that can then heat up and can keep the heat in. So seeing him do that, I was absolutely turning cartwheels and cheering that someone is insulating their shelter and insulating their roof.
Andreas and Rick both visibly losing quite a bit of weight. That's an issue for cold. We saw Andreas making up a little mouse trap. It's been a while since he's had protein, no deer, no fish. How do you rate his mouse trap? Do you think he's actually going to catch anything with that?
It's like the mouse was just giving poor Andreas the finger. When he started making that mouse trap, I was curious as to why he wouldn't make one that could do a possum and a mouse. And it's probably conservation of energy, but to make something that would be big enough to have a possum and also tackle a mouse, and maybe that's not possible. I don't know. I'm not a huge trapper. It's a great little design. Like his trap is beautiful, but that moment when the mouse gets away, that has got to be one of the most demoralizing moments when you're starving, because you're finally like anything. There's just, I'm just got just one mouse. That's all I need. It's going to have bugger all calories, but it's something. To then see on the camera that that mouse got away, that's when you're starving, that's crushing.
Watching Andreas making his little mouse trap, I couldn't help but recall a previous Alone season in America where there was a participant who was living off mice.
Oh, the one he hated the mice.
Yeah, hated the mice. And I just remember thinking, like, this is the basest it gets, really. Like, this is the...
Like primal.
Yeah, primal. You know,
primal,
like,
survival.
Proper Armageddon, and he's living off mice. And for someone like Andreas, who's, you know, a hunter, who would have gone in there with grand plans of catching a deer, and he's sort of gone, like, deer, down to possum, down to fish. Down to mice. I wonder what that does to your sort of your emotional trajectory here.
Yeah, yeah, a lot. I think what we see in every season of Alone is the place where participants come in with expectations, and expectation is the enemy of experience. Like, we come in thinking, I'm going to be doing this, and this is what I'm going to rely on. Here's my plan, and I've got it in my back pocket, and this is the way I'm going to get through this. And nature very quickly takes our plan and turns it into a paper airplane and then sets fire to it. And now we're left with capital R reality. And what we're seeing is Andreas is a hunter, and his hunting chops are beautiful to watch. The way he's constantly, this isn't working, what's a new strategy? Loving watching him do that. But he's having to really let his expectations go and to face the part of him that is, oh, now I'm down to mice. And he's a big guy. Lots of calories to move that rig. Not getting any of them. There's another thing that I see in this episode, which is people getting broken down to their sort of like the very base philosophies. The what do I need? And in the storm, he talks about being passive, that passivity is actually the wisest course of action. And that's so true. Conservation of energy. It's like, if it's pissing down rain and I can't go fishing, just dive into the sleeping bag and wait it out.
Rick lost 14 kilograms by the 30-day mark. He came in, lean.
Pretty, yeah.
Seemed
pretty
like
lean.
It. Under all those clothes, he's damp, he's cold. We saw him get the wobbles. We know where it ends with Rick now, having seen the episode. But he showed remarkable resilience to go this far with such little protein too.
To not have eaten for a month on his frame, like, the resilience and the will of that guy is epic. I've been saying the whole time, like, he's such a seasoned kind of survival athlete in that way. And you can see that he's really worked on his mindset. He's worked on his internal management of his emotions and of his mindset. And you actually see him working with his mindset to get to the point where he comes to the decision to leave. And I'm really looking forward to chatting with him about that.
Yeah, for sure. In this episode, we learn about him losing his sister. We also learn from Susan about her struggles not being able to have kids. And Tamika revealed that she once struggled with alcohol. So there's a bit of a sort of theme running through the episode of, you know, spending so much time with yourself in your head, bringing on this real deep self-reflection.
Yeah. Again, this is a side effect of starvation. Not just solitude, but starvation, because in our culture, we eat our feelings. You know, we can sedate our feelings with food, but out there, you can't eat your feelings. You can't distract yourself. There's nothing in the way. And once that starvation kicks in, the emotions start to come up. And so we see these beautiful shares and this vulnerability that I think is a hallmark of this show, that once you get people into the experiment of Alone, our masks start to dissolve and who we really are underneath all of those, you know, all those parts of ourselves, that starts to come up. And it's one of the things I love is when participants show their vulnerability, then we get to fall in love with them. We get to say, oh my goodness, that's like me. You know, I'm like that. You know, it's like when Christoph shared his neurodivergence. Like, it's such a huge, courageous thing to do. Mm. And we've got Susan talking about this incredible process and the grief of not being a mother. Mm. And we've got Rick with the grief of losing his sister. Tamika, what it took for her to be able to be on the front line of the police force. And ultimately, these are the things we all carry inside of us, but it can be a lot for us to feel safe enough to share. And it's so much more to share to a camera that is then going to go on national TV. And the courage that it takes everyone to do so is so beautiful. But I think it helps us to relate to every single person and go, yeah, I've got stuff like that inside me too.
Talking about relatability, I loved Tamika's comment about showing up the guys in the tackle shop.
Yes, sis.
She's killing it. She's a master fisherman.
Yeah.
Fisher person,
yeah. And she is like, yeah, they're stonkers.
Yeah.
They are absolute stonkers.
It's 64 centimetres.
Oh, my God. I'm so jealous.
It's her fifth fish in 9 days, 3.5 kilos. How does that compare to the fish you were catching in Tassie?
That is like comparing the difference between a motorbike and a Formula One car. That is proper fuel. What she has there is actual food that can last you not just through starvation. That's sustainability.
Puts the stonk in stonker.
It puts the stonk in stonker.
She's in a really great headspace. Mm. Yeah, she looks happy. She's speaking about that being her home now.
Yeah, that's interesting because, again, coming back to shelter, yes, you can have a minimal shelter that does the job, but when it feels like a home, now you can relax and feel safe and feel warm and cozy and held, and that's the kind of mindset you need to last the distance. So my money's still on Tamika.
Do less, catch more.
Do less, catch more. Beautiful philosophy there as well.
When she said it, I was like, that's easier said than done. But then I was like, she's actually doing it.
Yeah.
She's living that. Yeah.
And conservation of energy. Like, that's the most important thing. Every calorie I spend is a calorie I have to go out and, you know, risk getting cold and wet and hypothermic to replace. Mm. So Andreas, hunker down. Tamika, do less, catch more. Like, we're now down to the really essential philosophies of survival.
Mm. We started with five, we ended with four, Rick tapping out. Were you surprised to see Rick go?
No, I wasn't. I've been watching his incredible journey, but because he hasn't been catching any food on that frame, like, I'm actually amazed he's lasted, and especially with that shelter, I'm amazed that he's lasted as well as he has. He's a tenacious fucker. I mean that in the best possible way, Rick.
No beefs. So what questions were you left with for Rick?
I really want to find out about his shelter. I really want to find out how he managed to maintain that tenacity and that resilience. And I'm really curious to get into his backstory to see how his past has given him these incredible skills that saw him last so long and end also with such resolution for himself. Mm. Like, he gave us that I am my own king monologue, which he gave us at the beginning. It was so Shakespearean. Mm. And I really feel like he was a bit of a Shakespearean presence in a way, in a storytelling way in this series.
Well, he's coming up next as our guest on the podcast, so let's ask him.
Fantastic.
We spoke to survival educator Rick briefly in the first episode of this podcast, talking about the first day that he landed in the wilderness. And Gina, that feels like it was a lifetime ago.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, Rick made the call to head home this week, back to his wife, Neryl, his family in Queensland. And there's so much that we have to ask him. Rick, straight off the bat, a couple of times we saw you reciting a mantra, I'm the captain of my ship. What is that mantra and what does it mean to you?
Yeah, it's a good one. I caught a few people by surprise, I suppose, and probably even my own family. But I have a friend, I suppose, I don't know him that well, but a musician, and he brought out a song, and the song was called Be Your Own King. And there's a line in amongst that says, yeah, be your own king, do your own thing. And I suppose that element of being a captain of your ship and making a decision to do the things you want to do for your own reasons. And that's where it branches off. And the other one about, definitely being the husband to my wife and the father to my sons and the brothers to my siblings, that was all very much the grounding aspect of what's important to me in life. And that's something I needed to stay true to and consistently ground myself to create that, emotional buoyancy as to why I'm out there. And ultimately it is. So I am my own king and, I'm not there for anybody else.
We've had a lot of people online commenting on your amazing mental strength and attitude. How did you find being out there compared with other challenges in your life, and how much did you have to lean into those skills?
Yeah, it is an interesting one. I think when we go back a little bit to that first bit of an interview that we had, and I wasn't fully aware of the term of drop shock until actually after I had a bit of a listen to it. And I suppose that was the one thing that I didn't feel that heavy on. I had quite a state of calm going in, and I bizarrely had the same state of calm coming out. But being in amongst there, it was definitely not something that I felt fearful of. It felt like a sort of home away from home, yet it's pretty hard to unpack that in the sense that there's a lot of moving parts to being out there and a lot of forethought. Yeah. You can bring yourself unstuck very quickly if you're not thinking for the next day and the next week, and everything doesn't fall into your lap the way most people may expect it to. You may have a whole range of skills that might equip you for being on the show, but it doesn't mean it's all going to fall into your lap. So having that, mental resilience to understand that things will go wrong and just roll with them, deal with them.
We saw you meditating early on. What role did that play in that, state of calm, mental calm that you had? And did you continue the practice of meditating during your time out there?
I certainly set myself the goal of, grounding myself each day. Certainly the Namu, the sandflies, had different plans, and it was definitely very, I think I made the quote about the Buddhist monk testing them out, but I'd love to have a Buddhist monk there and see how it goes, because they are a challenge. And so that idea of starting your day and going and sitting and just being present, where you're just constantly slapping yourself, those plans got thrown out of whack, but it's been opportunistic to take the time to ground yourself whenever you can, and that could be when you're on a walk and you see something quite spectacular of just the foliage, the moss, the surroundings, and just how picturesque it was. It's just stopping for a moment and taking it in, because these opportunities don't present very often, and continually grounding yourself, I think, is very healthy, not just there, but in day-to-day life, noticing the small things and allowing that to bring it back home, that we're very fortunate and should be very grateful for the life that we do live.
Some participants going into alone put on a lot of weight on purpose. It seemed that wasn't a pathway you'd went down, although you probably put some on, but you certainly didn't go in like loaded with body fat. And then you didn't eat for a very long time. How did you find starvation brain affected you?
I certainly put on as much weight as I could from finding out I was on. I'm a bit of a glutton for cream, or it's a bit of a weak spot of mine anyway. I love cream, so I'd put it on my Weet-Bix. My boys reckon I'd put it on a meat pie if I could, sort of thing. But I love cream, so cream was on everything, and a lot of obviously olive oil and avocados and fatty meats and things. Certainly getting on as much as I could. So I think I put on 10.5 from my fighting weight. So when I first saw. Now, when I first witnessed myself going into the water for a dip, I was looking at all the rolls of Michelin fat around me there. That was certainly an aim to put on as much as possible, but I'd also told myself that I didn't intend to eat for the first week. Now, that's not saying that I wouldn't be opportunistic if something came in at 5 days and was opportunistic for me to take. Absolutely, but I had other priorities of making sure that the shelter served me structurally well until that was squared away. I wasn't going to be putting my focus towards food. And if I look back to survival training, and it's pretty universal around the world that, water, shelter, fire, food are the main priorities, and obviously rescue, but not in this case. But spending that first 7 days without eating, I I didn't find it difficult, I suppose, because I'd already acknowledged myself that I probably wouldn't be eating.
Then you went for 30 or 35 days without food. And I'm curious, because you're a veteran, like, you know, you understand survival, you've put yourself in many survival situations. I'm curious how this stacks up against things like your SAS experiences and what you noticed about starvation brain in you.
Yeah, I think it was day 8 when I got the first fish. And that takes you on that emotional, I suppose, awakening to think, okay, so there are fish here. If I can get one of these every couple of days, then you start to, and I think I sort of mentioned in the first episode, it's like that sort of, you know, Fortnite game where you see the things come up to say, okay, fish, that's a reliable source. But you soon find out that they're not that consistent. But comparing it to the military is quite different. It's like the military will never really put you in a situation where you don't have food. Normally, they really put you in a situation where you don't have reliable water. You know, they know for a soldier to function, they will definitely provide those. But you're also trained in the sense that should you be, you know, behind enemy lines, or should you be in a situation where you need to get from point A to point B in hostile territory, then you will need to fall back on those skill sets that allow you to live off the land and set traps and snares and catch animals. And yeah, it's a different sort of mentality, but the military aspect is quite different from the situation I was placed in alone. Yeah.
Rick, we're all a bit surprised to see how light you chose to keep your shelter. Could you take us through your decision-making process there and why you opted against making it a bit more insulated?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons there, Darren. For one, I was in quite a dark area of forest, about 15 to 20 metres back in from the shoreline. Well, when I look at the things that I thought may have been challenging on the series, it was certainly making sure that I stayed emotionally buoyant, that I didn't let things get to me. The other one was being able to secure food. One I didn't take into account greatly was the importance of sunlight. Of course, we're in the winter of New Zealand, of a latitude south, and that didn't allow a lot of sunlight during the day. I had the mountains behind me to the east, so it was a long time before sun actually hit the bay, I suppose. So light was the biggest thing I wanted as much as I could, providing I had the shelter and the rain. The only water I would ever get come in is that little bit of a fine mist if the wind was swirling around. I'd get a little bit of mist coming in. But it was never really a major issue. I never got wet as such. The only time my sleeping bag got wet was when I put my Dreiser bone coat over my sleeping bag, and it was a condensation from inside that set that water level on my bag. But I didn't get wet as far as any rain or storm coming in. And so being able to lay down in my shelter and be able to see daylight all around me was pretty important, especially if the opportunity of a deer walking up the path, I wanted to be able to see it. That idea of being closed in and not potentially having opportunistic prey or animals, possums, you know, or a deer wandering up and me not seeing it, I wouldn't want that. I'd hate to see the footprints around my shelter the next day and think I've just missed out on seeing an animal walk past my shelter. Yeah, so it was one I had to juggle. I guess I also didn't want heavy structure against there. If we had big storms and I had potentially timber and everything fall down on top of me during the night. But I'm also very much minimalistic. Some would argue that, hey, if you've got an opportunity to cut down more vegetation and make it more like a home, yeah, I could see reasons for it. But at the same time, it was a long time between meals and I had a long walk to go and get reliable driftwood to make those structures, and that was energy out where I couldn't guarantee energy in. So would I review that again? I probably wouldn't do a lot different. Maybe I might fortify one part of my shelter structurally a bit stronger, but I generally say pretty dry.
You've had quite a bit of time now to reflect. How do you feel about your decision to leave when you did?
I feel a real sense of contentment. Yeah, I think it comes off the back of, like you're saying, that sense of calm when I went in and being able to explore and really not just go there for the purpose of looking to hunt and survive on the land. It was definitely a journey within finding who I was after some pretty emotional times leading up to it, you know, that linger on. So living in a busy world, we do bombarded by everything that we are. It's difficult to know what questions you're actually asking yourself. And as you would know, Gina, the only way that you'll find that is to be alone, pardon the pun. But I'd recommend for anybody, you know, and you don't have to do it as tough as we do, but go and spend a week alone in the bush. Go and take a tent or a tarp and be minimalistic. If you need to have a push button for an emergency, go for it. But just take away that link of being able to talk to somebody or be on social media going, hey, I'm by the creek surviving on the land. You know, it's just find that time alone. Yeah, I think it's just therapy.
Rick, you said you felt your sister Mandy while you were out there. Tell us a bit about the kind of person that she was.
I suppose if we take it back to my childhood, when the wheels fell off the family cart, as I say, I would have been about 6 years old. So us all being foster children and heading off to different homes, it wasn't a smooth running journey for about half the siblings. And as a result, her journey wasn't an easy one. But in the end, her health declined to such a point that she passed away. And that was emotional in that sense, and it hit me pretty hard, in particular on this day 2 years ago. It was a heavy emotional day, and I'm very thankful that I've got my loving family and wife around me that allowed me to recalibrate and know that, you know, yeah, just, you know, you've got a sister and she was loved, and we done everything we could. Yeah.
And then you're out on alone and you came across those trees. And really, you know, we got to see you sort of feeling into your relationship with your sister.
I got to that spot in nature, and it was just like you're walking into something out of Avatar. It's just absolutely stunning. And whilst you might be on a hunt, it's certainly worth just stopping and just taking in your surroundings. And that actual location where I shot that bit of footage was where I stood and just admired these massive big brown pines, which were the ones we were getting the Miro berries off, but they were just sitting there in their grandeur, and it reflected my three sisters. And that's when it, yeah, really sort of, I felt the presence that my sister was with me, and there wouldn't be anyone that would be more proud of what I was doing. I mean, she admired very much what I was doing in the father and son sphere. Mandy very much was the biggest advocate and or fan leader of what I do there, and she'd always be talking to people and her carers and things about, you know, her brother Rick and what he does. So, yeah, it was that, I don't know, call it warm and fuzzy if you like, but just that presence that, you know, she'd be proud of me sitting in that environment, you know, to a degree in my element.
Thanks for sharing that, Rick. That's lovely. Another of your greatest supporters, you told us in this episode, is your wife, Neryl, and we have roped her in to joining this conversation. I wonder if we might be able to bring her in here, because we'd like to ask her a couple of questions about the legend that is Rick.
Lovely. I'll get you to come in, darling.
Pleased to meet you, Neryl. Hello, I'm Darren.
Hi, Darren. Lovely meeting you.
And I'm Gina.
Hey, Gina.
How's it been watching Rick's journey?
Fantastic, emotional, exciting. Yeah, taking it all in. Last night was a big night.
You must be immensely proud of him.
Yes, extremely. Totally loved watching what he was doing, and I knew he would love every minute, even when his boot broke and, you know, all of that. And I was like, he just would be in his element.
And how about that amazing solution as well when your boot broke? Do you see him doing that kind of creative solution, MacGyvery stuff around the house?
Yes, I do. Whatever needs to be done, he'll go and find something in the shed or go for a walk and there'll be something he needs and he'll bring it back and then make the fire from scratch every day. Oh, not every day, but in the backyard during the week. And there's never a lighter to use. It'll be bow and spindle or whatever way he sees fit on that day. So, yeah.
You're obviously well across, you know, Rick's skill set and, you know, how well he's suited for an experience like Alone. But what was your reaction when you found out that he'd been accepted to go on the show? Did you have any concerns at all?
Oh, no, not at all. We were so excited. It was amazing. Wasn't concerned in any way, shape or form. Every night when we sat down, when I sat down with our boys to eat, we would always say, oh, hope Rick's got a belly full of food and he's warm and having fun. And that was like the main things. But no, I was never concerned about, I never lost sleep over it. I knew he was loving it.
Can you tell us what was in the letter you gave him to take?
The deep love that we have and to take opportunities and knowing that with the stability at home is everything is okay. And yes, I think when difficult time comes, instead of being up here in the head thinking, like Rick was saying, to get grounded, have a breath and take a moment and connect with his heart to know, to know the answers will come.
And what a huge heart it is.
Big heart. He has a big heart for many.
And how was it to see him when he returned? Must have been great.
It was really, really great. He was a lot thinner. And we do laugh about the weight he put on because he's a very lean man. So to have 10 kilos on Rick, he was carrying a bit.
Had my love handles.
Yeah, it was lovely to see him and hear his journey. And he didn't tell us a lot of things. I think that's an SAS thing. And we don't ask many questions. So we're grateful for what he shared with us. And then we had to sit and watch the program to find out all the details.
Were there any surprises when you sat down and watched it together?
Oh, one fish in 38 days. Yeah.
Rick, how was it when you got home, and were able to, give Neryl a hug and your son, see your sons as well? How was that for you?
Yeah, Neryl had organised a B&B out in the country. So whilst I did come home and drop off my bags and give my sons a hug, we then basically went for a drive out into the country and just allowed that to unfold. And, certainly obviously when you come off the land, there is that process of making sure that you're medically fit again and you're looked after in that refeeding program. And that aftercare was second to none. That was incredible. And that was a really good transitional period, I guess, before coming home to the noise of the normal world and being able to spend 2 or 3 days with my wife and just sit and, super, super lucky man to have such a beautiful, loving wife that I have,
I'm the lucky one.
Were there some epic meals?
Epic meals. Yeah.
The home-cooked meals, the lasagna and the cauliflower bake with the cheese sauce. I'm starting to salivate thinking about it,
So what's been the response of your friends and your family, Neryl?
Really positive, and no one asked any questions when Rick was away because he normally goes away. So we didn't have to say too much. But when we would get together, myself and the boys, that's when we wanted to have a chat because there was no chatting outside the house. And now the love that has come in and the richness of Rick's a winner in life anyway. And, it's been really lovely. It's good. It's grand.
Neryl, thank you so much for joining the chat. It's really, I think, added a new dimension to Rick and to our conversation too. So thank you so much. We've now got the last section of this chat, which is the quick fire round. First question, what's one word to sum up your alone experience?
Epic.
What was the best of your 10 items?
A knife.
What was your biggest mistake?
You might think it's the boots, but there was a journey. Not knowing there were good quality gum boots on the market that are insulated. And then flash them ones,
What was your best lesson?
Gratitude.
Would you rather sand flies or leeches?
Leeches.
What's your favourite camping spot out there in the world?
Probably Kakadu.
Who or what did you miss the most?
Certainly my loving family. Not a need sort of want, but just certainly knowing that they're there for you when your time is up, they're there for you. Yeah.
What would you tell someone thinking of applying for a loan?
Do it for their own reasons.
And would you do it again?
Would love to.
What's next for you?
We're off to the Kimberley shortly with my son. We've been invited on a film invitational with 10 other teams, and I'll put a team in with myself and my two sons, and we're going to go remote with just myself and my sons on a pretty epic filming adventure in the middle of nowhere, a bit of abseiling, yeah, all sorts of stuff. It'll be great.
So it's back to the cameras for you.
Yeah, and hopefully cameras are and podcasts are a big part of the future. I love that concept. I think it's great.
Great, Rick. Look, you've been a great podcast guest. And Neryl, thank you so much for joining as well. It's been great to watch your story unfold over the last couple of months, Rick. It's been great to chat to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Lovely. Big love to you guys. Thank you.
Just quickly, out there in the world, so many people have been coming up and we've been having chats about Alone and really giving you love for your whole journey. You've definitely been a fan favourite, and I think a lot of people have learned from your attitude and your buoyancy, and I think you've inspired a lot of people out there. So thank you and well done.
Lovely. Thanks, Gina. Thanks, Darren. Appreciate your time.
Singer-songwriter Josh Pyke, you've been a pretty big deal in Australia since like the mid-noughties, since Middle of the Hill came out, let's say a household name, I think, but in your family household, the Alone TV series seems to have top billing. You and your family really are mega fans of the Alone series.
We are, yeah, we're huge fans. We've watched every season, I think there's 20 seasons something, isn't there? So we've watched all the international ones, and then when SBS started doing the Australian one, we were just like absolutely over the moon.
What drew you to it?
Well, so we actually got into it during COVID. I think my sister recommended it to me in the first place. And then it was just something about, you know, we'd collect, you know, in the couch during COVID when the world seemed such a crazy and uncertain place. And there was something just very wholesome and sort of inspiring about these people toughing it out in the wilderness.
You binged like 15, 16 seasons.
Yes,
in like...
Yeah. 100%. Yeah, we bonded over it. My kids, you know, got heaps into survival stuff. And so every birthday and Christmas, it was all like ferro rods and, you know, they've got like great little multi-tool knives and stuff, and they have their survival kits. So whenever we go on holidays or camping to the bush or whatever, they'll take their survival kits. So yeah, it's been a big part of our lives.
With that, going into the bush and them, you know, building shelters and their survival kits, how are their skills? I find that kids really get it, and they often get pretty good.
Well, I think it's all about imagination. That's one of the things that I love about Alone, is it's about imagination and creativity and using what's around you. So yeah, just recently we were away and we made a shelter with a tarp and everything, and we used a rock face as the back of the wall. And then my son was like, yeah, but if it rains, then the water will come down here. So we need to fold the tarp over so that, you know, it protects the back of the shelter. And then we got all these fern fronds to make the sides. We got covered in ticks, unfortunately.
Oh. But were they the big ones or the little baby
the
ones?
The tiny baby ones.
So they're seed ticks. And what happens is the tick mama will lay all of her eggs all at once, and it'll be this tiny little dot on leaf, and then you brush past it and suddenly you've got 300 baby ticks
all over
your whole body.
That is very much what happened to us. I've still got like all over my like thighs and my stomach. Oh my God, it was killing us. But it was worth it. And we did start a fire with a ferro rod, so it was cool.
Is a ferro rod as easy to use as it looks?
No, we struggled. It took us probably 25 minutes, and that was with, I can't remember what season it was from, but somebody in Alone once cut a little bit of their t-shirt off. Was that you?
That was me.
Was it really?
That was me.
Well, because so I did that. I was fantastic. Like, well, you know, if it's, you know, if you're allowed to do it alone. So, you know, I got a little bit of my pants had a tear in it anyway. So I got a bit of cotton from my pants, and that's how we got it started.
Yes.
There you go. I didn't even realize it was you. That's great.
Yeah, that was me. And it was after the first day of trying to get my fire, and I had all these ideas about, okay, fire's my thing, and all of the intro stuff I've said that fire's my best skill. And then everything was wet, and I didn't have any tinder, and I'm just crashing and burning, going, oh my God, this is day one.
Yeah.
And already I just look like a total doofus. What am I going to do? And I was like, okay, this isn't quite ideal, but.
Well, I don't know why everybody doesn't do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I don't think people knew, but now they do.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great idea. And again, that's the thing, like imagination and creativity and using what you have is the key to get by, right? So, yeah.
Much like you, I got into a loan during the lockdowns, the pandemic. It came along at a funny point in time for a lot of people where we're all locked down inside, looking at four walls every day, every night. And all of a sudden there's this show which offers you raw nature and people in at the, you know, the most natural.
It was the expansive environment, I think, that was so appealing. You know, the expanse of these mountains and, you know, as I said, we watched all the seasons, you know, with Roland with his rock cave, something very primal about it. And I guess also in the back of our minds, there was a weird apocalyptic sort of sense to the world at that time. Yeah. And maybe everyone was kind of thinking, well, if it all goes down, how would we manage? So, yeah,
I don't know. I think it's the answer.
So taking that, because that's something else I find that the kids are really like, well, when the world ends, we're good.
Yeah, yeah.
Has it changed your views about sort of where civilization's going and what's coming and possibly preparing for transitions?
Well, my younger son, he's always talking about like what he would do. But I think it's like you don't want to sort of buy too much into that kind of level of social anxiety, because that can, I think, during COVID in particular, there was that general sense of social anxiety of what is going to happen. What, you know, every day I was reading the news and like, oh my God, what's going to happen next? It's quite a stressful period in history. But in terms of how the show has influenced the way I see the world, I think for me, it's more that I always find it inspirational that it's like the natural world is going to continue. It's just going to do its thing no matter what we are doing. And I find that very humbling and actually quite comforting in a way. Mm. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Is there a particular season of Alone that resonates most with you or any particular experiences of participants?
I can't remember the exact season, but it was the one where Roland made the rock cave. And the thing that I liked about it, apart from his incredible survival skills, was the fact that he was a guy that really didn't seem to fit into society. But during the process of him being on that show, he seemed to reflect on how much he actually loved his family and stuff like that. And I think that isolation is something that you see in every, I mean, with yourself and with all of the people participating, you do see that the mental aspect of being actually alone mentally reconnects them with their community and with their loved ones and makes them really appreciate how important those things are.
I find that in all of the series, that's one of the things that I've always really loved about Alone, is that people come in with their stories about themselves, their ideas about the world and how they are in it, and nature breaks us all. I would always be like, no, I like this one, but I don't like that one. But by the time people tap out, I love them all because of that process, because by the end they're reflecting and they've taken some lessons or they've discovered things about themselves. I'm curious, how has that impacted your boys and their internal sort of like emotional processes?
I think the idea of just being capable is a big thing. And so we don't do heaps of screens with them. And my youngest son the other day said to his mum, he was like, we have a lot of freedom in the real world, but not online. And she's like, yeah, that's true. Because they ride their bikes around the neighborhood. I gave them their first pen knives when they were three.
Awesome.
which is maybe not a good idea, but it's been fine, you know.
Yeah, that's how they learn.
They both have whittling kits. So they sit out on the back deck and just whittle, like instead of watching TV and stuff, and they play with fire a lot. They make little mini forges and stuff like that. So I think how it's influenced them is that they feel quite capable, and I think that's really important. They definitely have way more suspicion and sort of wariness towards the online world than they do to the natural world, which I think is really good.
What a beautiful gift.
Yeah, I think it's great. And we live in the suburbs. It's not like we live in the bush or anything. It's just, I'm a child of the 90s. That's what we did, right? We were just out walking the streets and, you know, lighting fires and doing stuff that you just wouldn't get away with today. So I think it's sort of trying to impart a bit of that idea that kids are way more capable than they are told that they are in 2023, 24, whatever we're in.
Teaching like real core skills that screens discourage, which is, you know, if it's just sitting and whittling, it's sitting with your thoughts.
Boredom is the mother of creativity, you know, like, and I know that as a musician and creative, it's like, you're not going to think of an idea for a song or a book or a story when you're scrolling through Instagram. You're going to think of it when you're just walking around or just being bored, sitting outside. And that's when all creativity comes.
It's one of the things that I find kind of heartbreaking about our culture at the moment is we're so geared for distraction. Like we pathologize discomfort so much that as soon as we're feeling slightly antsy in ourselves, there's a way of distracting ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And for people like us, I mean, I was what you're doing in the 90s, I was doing in the 80s and probably the 70s, that boredom, like I can remember hanging out with my sisters and my cousins and a whole bunch of friends, and we're down at like a waterhole and we've got this old daggy canoe.
Yeah.
And so we're like, well, we've got nothing to do. What are we going to do? So we put it in, and then we started off with only two of us in it, and then three of us in it, and then six of us in it, and then eight of us in it. And it turned into, we had to come in at the end of the day because we were blue.
Yeah.
And we'd basically just been stacking this canoe and filling it with water and playing with it and turning it into forts and playing every kind of game with this one thing. And I just don't see kids so much doing that anymore.
Yeah, I think it's a weird thing where it's considered unsafe or something, but the risks in the online world are so much greater. Mm. I mean, my kids, when we go to like Kangaroo Valley, for instance, my folks have a place there and there's a creek there, and they'll just spend like 8 hours making a dam or making some elaborate filtration system, and then they'll find clay and then they'll make some pots, and then we'll have a fire at night and they'll put the clay in, you know, in the fire. And yeah, so I think it's, in some ways, you know, people could consider that slightly risky or whatever, but I think the things that people could accidentally come across online is way, way more potentially traumatic.
Mm. So Alone, Australia season 2.
Yes.
What are your thoughts? What's had you screaming at the TV?
Well, I mean, I think they're all amazing. And I was very sad to see Rick go because I loved his mental attitude. And I was reflecting on this last night when I was watching it. I was like, I reckon Rick could go all the way. But with his attitude, his positive attitude was so powerful that it got him through whatever it was, 30 days of no food, right? Whereas you see Andreas, you know, he's doing really, really well with the food, but his attitude, he's always feeling like he's failing and like not doing well enough. And I found it really interesting, and it made me think that if Rick had just got like a couple of fish, he probably could have outlasted them all. But, you know, physically he just couldn't keep going, which is totally fair enough. But yeah, I love it. I always find it, I'm sure it's in the editing, but the thing that always gets me screaming at the TV is when you see them catch a fish and then you're like, keep fishing. But I'm sure there is another 4 hours that
absolutely
actually happen.
Yeah. I can vouch for that. You don't see all the catches.
Yeah, right.
At all. I caught a lot more fish than you see. I mean, they're very clear that they don't show all of the catches. Every time you see them fishing, they generally don't just have one line in. They're going to have four or five in all at once. And after they catch their fish, they're probably going to be still fishing.
Yeah, you would imagine so. That's always the thing that I'm like, keep fishing.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I was thinking about that last night and I was like, I'm sure like Tamika, for instance, is, you know, on that ledge for for hours.
Until the light goes and it's like, right, I've got one fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've been loving it. I think Tamika is just a legend. I love her house. It's like a work of art.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's just so, I mean, and this is exactly the thing about creativity and imagination. You see the personalities, you know, like Andreas has this sort of like quite stiff European, you know,
Germanic
mentality.
And
it's very neat and everything's perfect. He's so hard on himself. And then Tamika creates this beautiful sort of billowy, like it looks like it's made out of something very soft, but it's all made out of this hard weathered driftwood. And I love it.
It's also a story. And so for someone like Tamika, when she's got this incredible house, it's like a fairy story house.
It is.
And every time she goes out, she comes back and there's that to come home to.
Yeah, yeah.
When I had my nest, like I'd come back and I'd be inside and I'd just be like, oh my goodness, this is a nest. Like the walls were woven and they went up like a meter and a half.
Yeah, yeah.
All the way around. And the story of that was something that every day kept me going.
Yeah.
And then we see Rick's shelter, which was
nothing.
Which was barely a shelter. And it's like his story, his SAS story of minimal impact and being able to pack up in a heartbeat or whatever. It's so beautiful in the show how you get to see people's stories reflected in the way they tackle it all.
That's really interesting. It's like their shelters are a reflection of their personalities.
Absolutely.
Andreas with his, you know, strict kind of, you know, hard on himself, you know, needs to be quite rigid. And then Christoph as well, he's quite a fantastic guy. I love his
talking
attitude
of creativity.
Yeah, he's quite a like fantastical kind of guy. And I like his shelter when he's putting all the dirt on the top of it and creating these, you know, ridge beams and everything. His is very fairy tale-ish as well. He is like a character from a fairy story.
Isn't he just?
Yeah, he's
absolutely
great. Yeah,
yeah,
from like a Hans Christian Andersen.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Love him.
So at this stage, do you have a favorite? Who do you think will win?
It's hard because you just never know. It's the mental element that always breaks people. I feel like Andreas is probably doing best with the food. And I like the way he's trying everything, you know, mm-hmm. like he's trying the mouse traps and he's trying different ways to catch possum and he's, you know, he's fly fishing, which is really cool and impressive. And he's doing it at night. And he's trying everything. If he can just hold his mental attitude together and not be too hard on himself, obviously you can't compare yourself to the other contestants. So he doesn't know how well he's doing. Mm-hmm. I think he could go all the way. But otherwise, I think Tamika is just very strong. Yeah. She's really... Last night, she really seemed to like sort of find her place in that environment. And when she was saying, like, she was like, you know, if I didn't have family, I'll just live out in the wild.
Mm.
So if she can just keep catching fish, then I think she could be out there forever.
Mm.
How do you reckon you'd go?
I think about it all the time. And actually, when I'm trying to go to sleep at night, I'm often thinking about what kind of shelter I'd build.
Oh my God, that's how it starts.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how I'd do, actually. I think I'm creative enough to, you know, probably last a little while, but the thing that would get me would just be missing my family.
Mm.
Like, even when I'm on tour and I'm away for 4 days, I start just like getting very homesick and heartsick, and I just, that would do me in within, I reckon, 10 days. I'd be like, oh, this is just, I just got to go home.
If you could do one that wasn't alone, that was you and your family, same rules.
Oh, I'd love that.
How long do you reckon you guys would last?
Well, I don't know. Maybe a couple of weeks, you know. I'm not going to pretend that we're like amazing survival experts. We don't actually have those skills. I love fishing, so we'd probably go all right at fishing. I don't know how well I'd go at actually hunting and killing an animal. My younger son is a vegetarian, so he wouldn't be able to do that. So, but I would give it a go for sure. I would love it. If there was a celebrity alone, but it was capped at like 10 days.
Be there in a heartbeat.
I would do it 100%.
Yeah. It's a good pitch.
Me and Ben Law, yeah, we'd be out there.
Josh Pike, thanks so much for joining us, mate, especially on the eve of a tour.
Yes.
So you're playing gigs in Tassie, WA, Cairns in May and June.
Yes.
People want to catch you. Dates and details are at joshpike.com/tour.
Yeah, or check out my Instagram page and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm a huge fan, so thank you for having me.
Oh, it's been absolutely marvellous having you for a chat.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Alone Australia, the podcast.
Next week, as well as interviewing one of the participants, our producer is going to put me in the hot seat to answer questions from you. So if there's something you'd like to ask me, please email alonepodcast@sbs.com.au.
The series is produced by SBS Audio. That's Caroline Gates, Max Gosford, Joel Supple, Jung Cheng Guo, Sophia Lee and Karen Okuda. Our thanks to Joseph Maxwell, ITV, Alone Australia's executive producer, Rima Dea, and of course, all the participants.